Hi, I'm Johanna Ferreira, Content Director of Pop Sugar Juntos. Juntos is all about celebrating Latinx culture, pride, our many intersectional identities, and joy. Thanks to support from Prime, there's so much to get into over at Juntos this month. From conversations with the Latinx minds behind our favorite new movies and resurrected TV shows, to thoughtful celebrity commentary and exclusive interviews with some of the biggest Latin music artists today. And it doesn't stop there. Get more of the music, movies, and shopping you love on Prime. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more of whatever you're into from streaming to shopping. And get all of our latest coverage at popsugar.com/juntos. Con amor, Johanna.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Ezra Klein Show. My guest today is Malcolm Gladwell, who is the author of, among many others, The Tipping Point, Blink, Goliath. He is a great, great, great journalist, and he also has a new and fantastic podcast called Revisionist History, where he's been looking at things that we think we know about and taking them from a very different angle. It is a fantastic, fantastic podcast. If you're not listening to it, you should be. And I was excited that we were able to talk today. We got very deep around journalism, around our approaches to it, around the ways in which it can function as a guild and an industry, and how that, I think, is at certain points made Gladwell feel a little bit outside of it. He talks about a lot about his process, about when he gets concerned because maybe he feels he is sitting a little bit too much in the mainstream. We talked about why he thinks the internet is sort of bullshit right now and why he thinks that in 30 or 40 years we will look back on this as a very strange technology. We talk a lot about folks who he has learned from and what he has learned from them about his theories of education. This goes in a lot of fun, interesting directions. I did not expect to learn, for instance, that when he was a high schooler in Canada, he started a zine and tried to emulate William F. Buckley and write like William F. Buckley and bring the Buckley spirit to his home country. So we get deep in a lot of different directions. It's a very fun episode, left me certainly with a lot to think about. And I think it will do the same for you. As always, before we get into it, please rate this podcast on iTunes. Please share it with your friends on Twitter, on email, on Facebook, wherever fine podcasts are shared. Please listen to my other podcast, The Weeds, which Malcolm Gladwell says a lot of very kind things about in here. So if you don't believe me that it is good, maybe you will believe him. And finally, please keep sending along your suggestions for folks who should be on the show, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Again, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. And so without further ado, here's Malcolm.
Hi, Ezra. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. You know, this is very exciting for me. You know why?
Why?
Because I am the world's biggest Weeds fan.
I am happy to hear that. That's exciting for me.
I love the Weeds. It's like, I promote it whenever I can. I tell all my friends to listen to the Weeds. So this is very exciting.
That's wonderful.
I have one complaint though.
Please.
You always, when I say you, I mean collectively, the three of you, make fun of the fact that people are listening to the Weeds. Or you make fun of the Weeds.
Yes.
You can't do that. You can't diss me for listening to the Weeds.
I need to stop calling you a lame, lame and wasting your time.
Yeah, every show, somebody takes a shot at the Weeds. I've never seen this before.
It speaks to a deep self-loathing.
It does. It has to stop.
Fair enough. All right. Well, I will relay that back. It's funny. For a long time when I was running Wonk Blog, we would sort of oscillate between having the public face of this stuff is amazing and it's super interesting, and then also doing a certain amount of self-deprecating if you're a really boring person who enjoys watching graphs. And at a point, we just decided like no more of the second part. We had to give up that affectation.
Yeah. Well, because it's not it's not boring. Right. It's actually super interesting. That's the whole point of The Weeds, is that you make it super interesting. So anyway.
That's great, though. I am very excited you're listening. That's wonderful to hear.
Also, where in Canada is Sarah Cliff from?
That's a great question. I don't know it offhand.
I just like to know where my fellow Canadians are.
Your fellow Canadian health reporters.
Yes, exactly.
I've always enjoyed occasionally going back into the old Malcolm Gladwell health reporting archives at the Washington Post.
Oh, yes. We amused ourselves back then.
It was a more amusing time. I actually thought, speaking of the Washington Post, that we'd begin there, if that's cool.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know much about that period in your career, and I've always been fascinated by it. We even covered some of the same issues there around healthcare. How did you end up at the Washington Post?
Largely, I think through an accident. I was roommates with Jacob Weisberg, now the head of the Slate Group, and Jacob was interning at the New Republic, where at the time Mickey Kouse was working, and Mickey used to come to our house for parties, and he got offered a job at the Washington Post, and he didn't want it, but he said, "Well, you should really hire this guy Gladwell." At the time, I wasn't even a journalist. I mean, I was just kind of like, and I have no idea how, but I somehow got in the system. I mean, I didn't get that job, but I was just entered into their HR database. And eventually my name came up and I went there and waved my fingers in the air. And that was at a time, I started there in 1987, when the Washington Post was so massively profitable that they were hiring everyone. That's, I think, the best explanation. So I was supremely lucky on a number of levels. And I started on the business staff. I had never written a newspaper story in my life when I started at the Washington Post.
What were you doing that had led Mickey to think you'd be a good fit there?
I was occasionally writing freelance stories for the New Republic. And I had previously written some freelance stories for the American Spectator. So I was a freelancer in D.C., but I was working at I had a day job at a think tank and was writing on the side basically for money, since I was making $14,000 a year. And I was going to go to business school. I had no intention of becoming a journalist. And then this Washington Post thing fell in my lap. It was very exciting.
You can tell me if I'm wrong. I have a vague memory that there is some magic around this house that you shared with Jacob Weisberg, that a bunch of other journalists who are now very well known either lived there or passed through there. Am I making this up?
There was, well, Jeff Rosen, who's now a law professor at somewhere in, I think, Georgetown or AU. There wasn't some kind of star-studded, but there were a lot of interesting people who passed through, but I don't know whether there was, I think this might be another house. Jacob subsequently had another house, which really was full of star-studded people. Atul Gawande and all those kinds of people seemed to pass through that house, but not ours. Ours was one step below that later famous one.
How did you end up in D.C. rooming with Weisberg at the first place?
I got a job out of college, also by accident, at the American Spectator, and a magazine that I had neither heard of nor read. But a friend of mine, I needed a job, and a friend of mine read it and said, "You should apply. They're looking for an assistant managing editor." And since I didn't know anything about it, I couldn't really write a proper job application. And so the main question was, why do you want to work at the American Spectator? And of course, I had no idea. So I simply wrote, "Doesn't everyone want to work at the American Spectator?" and I ended up getting the job, which is quite miraculous. And then that only lasted a few months. I got fired. And then rather than go home to Canada, I then just went to Washington, D.C. I was an illegal immigrant, and I went to Washington, D.C., and I was seeking my fortune. And I ended up in this group house that had an empty room, and we advertised, and Jacob answered the ad.
Why did you get fired at the American Spectator?
I had an incredible difficulty waking up on time. I had just been in college, and I had got into this habit of going to bed at 4 in the morning and waking up at noon, and I just couldn't make the transition to 9 to 5. It was as simple as that. I'd like to say there was some massive ideological dispute, but it was simply that I couldn't handle the hours.
Do you keep those kinds of night owl hours now?
No, I don't. I'm normal now, but I didn't go to class in college. And so what that meant was I adopted a radically, you know, a kind of non-class-based schedule. So that's how I was free to do that. And I used to go running at 3 a.m. in Toronto, which is a magical time to go running. And so it was really, that was the kind of impetus for it.
It seems that even if you had not been incredibly purposeful around journalism, that you knew that that's what you wanted to do, yeah?
Well, no, because I never, at no time, I always did it, but never thought it was going to be a profession. I thought it was something you did on the side. And I wanted to go to business school, as I said, and kept applying and just never followed through until finally I gave up and realized I should stick it out in journalism. But I had a zine in back when, if you couldn't, I don't even know. I think you're even too young. Are you too young for zines?
No, I know about zines, but I know about them more in an abstract way. I am the generation right after zines that emerges into blogs.
Yeah, I had a zine with...
Do you want to say what a zine is for those? As shocking as it is, some of our listeners are even younger than
even
me.
Younger. A zine is a homemade magazine. It's what you did if you lived in a little small town and you had some kind of pretensions to cultural importance. You made your own magazine and you ran it off on a Xerox machine and you distributed it to your friends. You know, lots of people had zines in the 70s and 80s. I had a zine called Ad Hominem, a journal of slander and critical opinion. And I did it with two people, my two best friends in high school, one of whom is now an opinion editor for the New York Times, and the other of whom is a history professor at Harvard University. These are my two in my little tiny weird Bible Belt town in Elmira, Ontario. Those are my two best friends, and we did this zine together, and we wrote opinion pieces, and the rule was you had to attack someone personally. That's why it was called Ad Hominem.
That's why these are the forerunners to blogs.
Yes, it was. My column was called The Moral Pejorative. And it was, I would invite people to write things under the understanding that I would then denounce them in The Moral Pejorative. We put out, I think, 6 or 7 episodes that were funded by the older brother of my friend Terry. It was great fun.
So who are you attacking as a high schooler? Are you attacking Canadian politicians? Are you attacking your teachers? Who is the target of Ad Hominem?
It was on a very high level. So this is 70s Canada, which is the kind of high watermark of Canadian left-wing dominance. And so the only way for us to rebel was to be conservative. So we were all obsessed with William F. Buckley. We wanted to be William F. Buckley. And so what we were doing is we were imagining if William F. Buckley was a 15-year-old Canadian living in rural Ontario and had a zine, what would he say? And that's basically what we were doing. We're channeling. We had collected every, me and Terry had gone to the used bookstores of Toronto and collected every William F. Buckley collection of columns secondhand and read them all, essentially memorized them. And we were attempting to reproduce him for our little tiny audience. So that was, we would write about, you know, El Salvador or, you know, what was wrong with the Trudeau government or, you know, like whatever the big issues of the day were. Well, that's what we were tackling.
So this is super interesting to me because it actually gets at something that I wanted to talk with you about. I'm always interested in which direction people came to journalism from. I know some folks who came because they love the craft of writing, the getting a perfect sentence down on paper or down on digital ink, I guess, is a true passion. And I know some people who love the craft of reporting. And then there are folks who ended up in these sort of policy magazines like The American Spectator or, as I did, The American Prospect, who were interested in arguing and in ideas and in oftentimes pushing a set of ideas or policies and almost saw journalism as a kind of activism. And it sounds to me that you at least begin in that last group. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yes, very much, I think. The three of us, these friends of Terry, Bruce, and I in high school, we were really mischief makers. So that was our primary motivation. We engaged in a whole series of actions designed to kind of gently subvert the school, of which one of them was Ad Hominem. But we did other things as well. It was all part of a kind of sustained campaign of mischief. We marched on City Hall, for example. We got
protesting
buses.
What?
Well, our principal, we had this principal who he was a lovely, sweet man called Roger Milliken, who we all liked. He was a kind of beautifully bland and boring and ordinary, but a wonderful principal, but nothing. He wasn't this charismatic, beloved figure. He was a kind of like, but they transferred him and we decided this was a spectacular opportunity to march on City Hall. So we got to protest his transfer. We arranged for the school buses at the school to transport about 300 or 400 students 30 miles to the county seat. And we marched half a mile down the main street of Kitchener, Ontario, all carrying huge signs. I remember, to this day, I have this picture up on my wall of me, Terry, and Bruce holding a big sign which said, "Hell no, Milliken won't go." And we were marching against the chairman of the Board of Ed, whose name was Wollstonecraft, and we had just read King Lear, I think. And so another one of the signs said, "Wollstonecraft, bloody sceptered tyrant." But it was in that spirit. I mean, it was all just mischief-making. I mean, it was like, we liked Milliken, but we liked the opportunity to like him more than we liked him. Do you know what I'm saying? It was just like kind of elaborate. And we did many of these things in high school. But of course, because it's Canada, this is something that I think Americans don't quite get about Canada. Everyone was complicit. So there was no opposition. No one got upset or in trouble. Or if you think about it, we took 300 students out of high school one afternoon, transported them 30 miles and had them march on City Hall. And there was not a single consequence to our action. Not a single one. Everyone was fine with it. The teachers thought it was hilarious. Milliken was like vastly amused, even though he never said anything. The chairman of the Board of Education. I mean, we stood with a megaphone under the Board of Education offices and with, 300 kids gathered around. And Bruce gave this extraordinarily absurd over-the-top speech, climaxing with, "You can run, Wollstonecraft, but you can't hide." So it was like that kind of thing. And no one cared because it's Canada. And what the whole sort of ethos was, very permissive in the best way. You know, I can't imagine that would be possible in Westchester County in 2016 at some high school, right? That people would flip out. But that was what Canada was like.
I'd actually love to hear your broader reflections on this. There is a cut on the U.S.-Canada difference that I think you hear a bunch, which is basically Canadians are polite, they're cheerful, they're pleasant. And it's basically saying that the difference between America and Canada is a gentle consensus reigns in Canada, whereas Americans are a little bit more burrish, a little bit more fractious. What do you think is the cultural differences between America and Canada that maybe people don't notice?
It's a really, really interesting question, because I think you're right. There's something quite fundamental that separates the two cultures. One is the thing that I was just talking about, but on a broader level, it is a disinclination to escalate social conflict. It's not that there isn't social conflict. It's that, like in this country, I feel like every opportunity, there is no opportunity for conflict that is missed. You see it, you seize on it, and you turn up the volume. Whereas at least the Canada of my youth was the opposite. You found conflicts and you found a way to push them aside. So there's, if you think about like that thing I just described of taking 300 kids out of school one afternoon, people looked at that and said, you know, it's kind of great that the kids like their principal a lot. We could make a big deal out of this, but what would be the point? So it was one afternoon. They missed school. You know, they missed school for an afternoon. They all came home safely. You know, that's sort of like, why would we jump at the opportunity to turn this into something bigger? So there's that. And there's also, though, and I tell the story about my brother, not in a way to lionize my brother, because I actually think this has less to do with my brother than it has to do with Canada. But my brother is an elementary school principal, and he was the principal of a little school out in a very, very religious rural area near where we grew up. And it was the most well-behaved school of all time. Basically, no one ever acted out. It was the most kind of charming, docile, happy parents kind of place. And he asked for a transfer to the most troubled school in the district because he was getting bored and he felt he was wasting his time. And then I said, well, that's unusual. He goes, well, actually, no. You know, and then he said, a lot of the best teachers wanted to be transferred with me because they felt they were wasting their time as well. And they said, well, you know, because people, the best teachers always like to go. He said this as if it was a matter of fact. The best teachers always like to teach at the toughest schools. And he looked at me like I was some kind of idiot for thinking otherwise. I just think that in that profession, and maybe it's broader than that, but in his profession, that's how they define their value. And it goes without saying that you'd want to, if you were going to do something in your career, you'd want to do it at the start at the bottom, not at the top. That's really Canadian somehow. I'm sure it happens in America as well, but just the idea that the profession is stamped with that attitude is a kind of something that strikes me as very, very typical.
Why in the end did you settle, it seems, semi-permanently in the U.S.?
Well, I was obsessed with America growing up. From the beginnings of when I could read, I read American magazines, Time, Life, got them every week. I read them literally cover to cover. I remember going into the library as a teenager and discovering the New York Review of Books. I mean, I'd never been to New York, let alone a major city in the United States, and being completely blown away. It just struck me as the place where there was all this intellectual excitement. And that's what I understand. I grew up in a farming town where in the country where nothing, I was bored my entire childhood. So I was kind of desperate for some kind of, you know, excitement, anything, drama, conflict. I was literally bored from the age of 6 to the age of 16.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden. But this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there is no way that Israel should be able to participate in Eurovision.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Burrow. Getting the right furniture for your place can be really annoying. At this point in my life, I've probably gone through maybe 3 sets of outdoor deck furniture, and it's a pain in the ass for a different reason every single time. It doesn't look like it did in the pictures, the assembly isn't what they said it was, or it's just not as advertised for whatever reason. Thankfully, Burrow is the furniture company that wants to make it all a little easier. Last year, Burrow introduced their outdoor line, and this spring they're adding to it with their Dunes line, offering new seating, dining, and lounger options designed for luxury, comfort, and durability. Burrow furniture is easy to put together and take apart, so you can move or store it as needed. And it ships straight to your door for free. Gray Area listeners can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/box. That's Burrow, burrow.com/box for 15% off. burrow.com/box.
I grew up in a suburb in Irvine, California, and Irvine is one of the first master planned suburbs in America. So, I mean, everything was perfectly laid out and decades of its growth were planned from the very beginning. And I would describe it very much the way you just did, right? It's mm-hmm. boring. It's calm. It was one of the safest cities in the U.S. And then I've wondered as I've gotten a bit older, if I talk to my friends who grew up in more objectively exciting circumstances, my friends who maybe mm-hmm. grew up in New York or in LA, would they not describe childhood and high school as a time when they were a bit bored? Is that a function of the child's experience, where there are things you want to do, but you just don't have the autonomy and the agency to do them? Or is it really something that is about the specific geographical limits in which you grew up? Because I just don't think I know anybody who doesn't, who won't on some level describe that period as a time when they were often bored.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I would only say, in comparison to friends of mine who grew up in cities, I did a lot less stuff growing up. You know, every summer I basically would work in the garden in the morning and ride my bicycle and read books in the afternoon. And I did that every day of the summer. I didn't go anywhere. We would travel to other countries once for, you know, a week a year, maybe a week every other year. But, you know, we weren't people who went out. I had two friends who I couldn't visit because they were, one of them lived 3-4 miles away. And how was I going to, you know, or I could bike there, I suppose. But, you know, we were out in the middle of the countryside. So I just feel it was, maybe all childhoods are boring, but I feel like mine was boring with an asterisk. It was like super boring. But again, that maybe I don't know. That's a really good question. I have no, I haven't done a controlled comparison of my boringness with the boringness of others.
Where do you come down on the argument that feels to me that it has become very fashionable to make in the age of smartphones and the internet, although possibly it was always fashionable to make, that we are depriving ourselves, our children, of boredom, that there is something deeply enriching about the experience of being bored? And in this age when you can immediately check Twitter, when you can always be looking at Snapchat, that kids and adults alike are losing some essential period of reflection or quiet mind that is going to ultimately stunt their creativity or hurt their attention span or somehow lead to an impoverished society or existence in the future.
I actually agree wholeheartedly with that. My mother would always say to me when I said to her I was bored, she would always say, "Good." Getting at that very reason. And I have found as an adult that I have had to defend my periods of extended reflection, that it's one of the reasons I'm a runner. And when I run, I do not put things in my ears, because the idea of getting an hour a day of solitude and reflection is hugely important. It's particularly if you're in the business that we're in, you know, you take in a lot of information. You have to have some extended period of time to reflect on it. Here I'm going to sound like an old man, and I'm going to repeat what people say all the time. But periodically, there are controversies within the sort of small intellectual journalist world. And my objection almost always to those controversies is that everybody who are – all these people who are purportedly independent-minded intellectuals move in lockstep. It's like none of them have taken the time to reflect on it in their own way. They are just simply responding to what a peer has said and saying and joining in. And that bothers me. I think that sometimes it's important to be different for the sake of being different, just to kind of express your own individuality. The issue I thought about this most recently was in the response to Jonah Lehrer's recent book. I've always thought the response to Jonah Lehrer's misdeeds is hysterical. And
do you want to just give a quick overview of the Jonah Lehrer background here?
Jonah Lehrer was a very successful science writer who was found to have fabricated some quotes from Bob Dylan in one of his books, and then subsequently found to have committed some other journalistic transgressions. And he kind of, his books were withdrawn. He was fired from The New Yorker. He went into a period of, for 2 years or 3 years or so. And then he came back with a new book recently, which was reviewed in the harshest possible manner in the New York Times, and then by Jennifer Senior. And then immediately a whole kind of gaggle of New York writers jumped on the bandwagon and kind of, in an act of kind of astonishing collective schadenfreude, sort of cheered on the dismantling of Jonah's attempted comeback. And I don't, you know, sure, people don't like him. That's fine. What I object to was this kind of unreflexive joining in in the piling on. You know, it's, or I guess you don't have to join in the pile on, but the unreflexive piling on, that always troubles me. And that speaks to what we're talking about, which is instead of instantly retweeting some gloating tweet about that book, why not spend a couple of hours thinking about your position and differ in some way from this emerging consensus? Nothing makes me more uncomfortable than the feeling that I am part of a consensus on an issue. Right? That's the most dangerous place to be in, I think, because it suggests that lots of the people, you're part of the unthinking majority.
What was so interesting to me about that moment, so Senior's review was unbelievably harsh. I read it and just in a kind of sympathetic human way, just cringed, right? Like imagining what that would be like to read as you're trying to make your comeback from an experience that had to be profoundly humiliating and shattering. Now, on the one hand, I thought reading that Senior has sort of earned her right to this opinion. She read the book. She does this kind of work. If she says this book is garbage, I think she is speaking from a place where she's earned that. But what was so fascinating to me about the response to that review, and I'm not saying that I don't join in this kind of thing myself, although I did not in this case, was that the people retweeting it and celebrating that review had not read the book. They hadn't earned any opinion here. They didn't know if this book was good. What was going on there was they wanted it to be bad. What the review did was there was something they were hoping was going to happen, whether or not they knew they were hoping for it. And that was that this guy who had risen so high, so fast, so quickly, and then fallen sharply. It had been proven that the way in which it felt to people like it had been proven that, yes, there really was something illegitimate about the way in which he lapped so many of his competitors. People wanted the continued narrative of his failure more than they wanted a narrative of comeback. And that's interesting. Yeah. Usually people, I think, are rooting for a kind of comeback. But in this case, the anger or the resentment had run so deep that when people were given the excuse to bury the book and bury him, they took it very fast.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think about afterwards why that was. Well, I'm curious if you have a theory on it, because it seemed very brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something about Jonah Lehrer that seemed to evoke the most kind of vicious and sanctimonious response from his peers. And I don't have a theory. I've never understood it. I don't understand why. I don't understand why, to give you a contemporaneous counterexample, why the journalistic community rallied in support of Gawker when they were sued by Peter Thiel over Gawker's decision to publish a sex tape of an encounter between a wrestler and his best friend's wife. And also Gawker's decision to out people who didn't want to be outed. That's the thing we're defending, whereas the guy that we're jumping all over is the guy who wants to write a scholarly book about love. There's a point at which I can no longer make sense of the kind of community's choices in who they like and who they don't like. So I don't have an explanation.
To discuss journalism a little bit anthropologically, it is a community. It is an industry. It has its mores. It has things it likes and things it doesn't like. It has a tone that it respects and a tone that it doesn't respect. And something that I do think is true here, and I feel this very much about the New York journalistic community in particular, there is a very high premium. And again, I'm speaking impressionistically. There are a million examples of everything I'm about to say being wrong. But it feels to me that there is a very high premium in much of the sort of publishing world placed on snark, on a continuous stance of knowingness. Gawker, in many ways, is a distilled version of that. It's often a very cruel version of that. And in my writing on the Thiel Gawker stuff, I think I come down, I don't like what Thiel's doing, but I come down pretty hard on what Gawker did. But Lehrer had his real sins. But I think one reason people were ready and waiting for him to fall is that he acts from a place of earnestness, from a place of he's a popularizer. He's like willing to enjoy things at a pretty baseline level. And I've just noticed a bunch of different times that is a stance that folks in journalism just don't love. And it comes against a lot of people. I think it comes against you sometimes. It's definitely, I felt it coming against Vox. The people really prefer a stance that begins from a space of superiority isn't the right word, but an ironic knowing, I think, is the right term for it. And earnestness is a little bit unpopular.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes whether what you're describing isn't a symptom of the falling economic status of journalism. All of this is against a backdrop of essentially economic crisis. When I joined the Washington Post in 1987, a job at a major metropolitan daily in the United States puts you firmly in the upper middle class, firmly in the upper middle class. In fact, papers like the Washington Post, you weren't even in the upper middle class. You could be in the upper class working there. You know, they were exceedingly profitable institutions that paid very well and that employed lots of people. That has all gone away. You know, journalism has both become, I'm not saying anything new here, it has become ubiquitous in our society, but it's no longer, there's no money attached the way they used to be. So the question is, what happens to any profession that is losing its economic place, right? How do the members of that profession respond? And I think that what we're seeing are the kinds of psychological defense mechanisms that people who are in status free fall, economic status free fall, adopt, right? They become very particular about who they want to let in and let out. They start to kind of fetishize certain moral stances or positions or codes as a way of sort of enforcing the in-group. I feel like that half of 1950s psychology was about what is going on in journalism right now. It is not dissimilar, actually, to some of the social mechanisms that are going on in other parts of American society that have suffered from this kind of economic dislocation.
If you know that 50s literature, what is the high-level gloss on it? What are, in those moments of transition, in those moments of friction, what kinds of responses emerge?
I mean, it is this search for when you lose one kind of status, one kind of point of differentiation, you have to replace it with something else. A very, very simple illustration of this is, why are pickup trucks so much larger today than they were 25 years ago, right? Have you ever seen a standard Ford pickup truck of 1975 up against a Ford 150 today? The contemporary Ford pickup is literally twice the size. I mean, I'm making that up. It's not quite twice. But, I mean, it dwarfs the old one. These are the same people buying those pickup trucks, doing the same jobs, but now their pickup truck is twice as big. And the answer is, in response to the falling economic status of kind of white working class jobs, people have chosen to assert their status in another way. I may not make the kind of money that I or have the kind of economic status I had 25 years ago, so I'm now going to compensate by having this truck that's twice as big. Or another version of this would be the observation that was made that Texas accents are far more pronounced today than they were a generation ago, that in response to the influx of outsiders to Texas, people from Texas now speak a kind of more pronounced form of Texan. It's an assertion in response to their feeling besieged, they reassert their identity in this kind of more prominent way. Those were ideas that were sort of played out in in-group, out-group psychology of the 50s and 60s. And I sort of feel like that's what I mean when I say that this is being played out in journalism today.
So one thing that I think is really interesting about this kind of conversation, because on the one hand, there's a piece of it that feels true to me. And on the other, I never feel like I know how to test it effectively against the counterfactual. So when you come to DC in the late 80s, early 90s, there is a very strong culture that is emergent at that moment around particularly the smaller magazines like the New Republic, the Washington Monthly, that crew. There's a very strong culture of counterintuitivism. And you've been talking about the little bit here, that the worst place to be is with the standard earnest take. I remember when I came to the American Prospect that we used to talk very seriously about being counterintuitive, that a lot of what our articles were like, no, you've heard, you know, giving money to poor people is bad, but actually it's what you originally thought. It is good. And that was part of the role we were playing. And, you know, industries, people, groups, they always have their sacred cows. They always have their internal cultures. I mean, I think a lot about the ways in which journalism developed a very mannered formalism in the way articles were written. And it justified that in terms of objectivity. It justified that as this is how journalism is done. But often it seems to me that we actually hadn't thought about it that hard. We had just gotten into a way of writing that showed we were journalists and other people weren't. So I think one question there is, how would we know if this was different or worse than it had been at any other point? I agree with you that there are ways in which the industry is weaker than it has been at other times. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that it hasn't had a similarly strong culture and in some ways even stronger safeguards against outsiders at other points in its history.
So back when you have some kind of shift in the professional status of the journalist in the following way, the generation that joined newspapers from the sort of in the post-war era, up through the decline of the newspapers in the 90s, you went to a newspaper and you were, it was very much a kind of apprenticeship. It was a guild in the medieval sense, and you were taught the kind of principles of journalism, two sources for everything, talk to both sides, you know, have the lead, the blah, blah, blah. And then if you stepped over the line, the lawyer came and told you can't say that, right? I mean, there's a whole kind of, I went through this exact thing where the crusty old editor says to me, where did you talk to this guy? And I'd say, I give some ham-fisted excuse not to. And he would say, talk to him or we're not running the story. You know, this whole, everything that you imagined happened, that it was, you know, everything you saw in 1950s movies in about newspapers, metropolitan dailies, was the experience. Like, that's how it was. When that kind of very strong conditioning environment goes away, it has to be replaced by something. And I think what replaces those kinds of codes of objectivity and correctness are a sense of codes about that have to do with attitude. And that's sort of getting to your point earlier about the culture of snarkiness and such. You can't have a profession without some kind of organizing identity. And the identity that journalism had through much of the 20th century died with the newspaper. And so the question is, what takes its place? And what takes its place is what you were talking about.
That's a super interesting point you just made, though, that we traded a kind of formalism for an attitude. Because if you back that out and you're saying, okay, what is one of your incentives as a journalist? Well, one of your incentives is to write stories that your peer group thinks are good. Mm-hmm. And one way you do that, one thing you could do to protect yourself and your stories was that you followed the rules. You know, you showed you had spoken to everybody. It was written like a newspaper story. You could look at it and it was clearly journalism. We're in a period of much more chaos in terms of what counts as a story. There is just a real profusion of formats. Some things are journalism, some things are not. Some things are a little bit on the bubble. People get criticized for doing work that other people don't get criticized for. I think there's a lot of, I employ a lot of young journalists, and I think there's a lot of anxiety right now among people of what kind of work will they receive backlash for doing. And one way that's more modern to protect yourself from the backlash, I'm not saying this didn't exist in any way in the 80s or 90s, I'm sure it did, but I think it's very salient now, is if your opinion is quote unquote correct. If nobody has an incentive to attack your opinion, then the fact that the opinion wasn't based on a super strong foundation of professional protocol is not going to get you in any trouble at all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny you mentioned that because I remember so many of my formative memories at the Washington Post were of watching much older and more experienced journalists deal with criticism. And you could deal with criticism by, they always would deal with criticism by referring to the formalism, by saying, you know, if someone called you up and you say, I talked to you or I talked to your people and they told me X, Y, and Z, or I mentioned that in blah, blah, blah. Or Michael Spector, my great friend who's now at The New Yorker, who was my colleague at the Post, used to always say to the person yelling at him on the phone, you seem to have forgotten one thing. I don't work for you, which is the point, right? I'm not partisan in this. I work for an objective institution which reports the news. Don't blame me for not agreeing with you. It's not my job to, right? That was our protective cloak. And now the cloak's gone. Right? And I think you're absolutely right. What do you have left? Well, maybe all you have left is to kind of follow along with the herd and let the herd protect you.
It's something that I struggle with a lot here. My pathway into journalism was very accidental. I did not intend to be a journalist. I did not want to be a journalist. I did not have any belief that this would be my career until basically it was. And when I was a blogger, I was part of a backlash to a lot of this formalism. I felt that a lot of the protocols of even-handedness made it very hard to tell the truth. I mean, the canonical, you know, is the earth round, opinions differ kind of thing. And there was, I think, value to that. I came to the Washington Post and being there, a lot of my work was somewhat controversial. And, you know, because I did not abide by some of these standards, I had a different approach and you know, certainly in my view, a valid one of getting things right. But certainly, you know, now I have a lot of concern that that stuff is going too far, that we were right, that phrasing your entire piece in this extremely mannered way to defer criticism makes it hard to tell the reader what is really going on. But the upside of, you know, the quote-unquote objective journalism, which I really hate that term because I don't think it was objective, but the upside of it was a process that forced you to talk to people on different sides of an issue did help you learn different arguments around that issue and did help you come to a better conclusion. And that somehow, you know, and I'm facing this a lot at Vox when I work with my younger writers, you want to keep what was good about that process and not necessarily recreate the end point. Something we talk a lot about internally was that we don't want a neutral product, but we do want a neutral or an open-minded process. But once you move away from the product, it becomes easier to hide a more biased process behind that.
Yeah. I thought of this, you know, one of the podcast episodes I did was called Food Fight, and it was a comparison of Bowdoin and Vassar's approach to financial aid, and sort of made the point that schools that are trying to spend the marginal dollar on financial aid, their lives are made very difficult if their competition chooses not to spend the marginal dollar on financial aid, but chooses to spend it on amenities. And the whole core of that piece was a ranking done in the New York Times in the Upshot column that ranked every major college in the United States on the basis of how generous and open they were to low-income students. So it was an objective ranking that put every college on the same footing. And so my piece was an act of advocacy built on an objective observation. And I spent a lot of time before I did that piece making sure that the New York Times index that they came up with was what I thought it was. That is to say, was it actually a fair measure of how open schools are, how generous they are towards low-income students? Having determined that it was, I then felt that I had a solid foundation on which to engage in my act of advocacy. And so there's a way in which, even in that instance where I was not doing a kind of standard by the book, newspaper, talk to both sides kind of piece, it was built on that foundation. It was made possible by somebody who took the time to come up with an unimpeachable way of comparing the records of different colleges, which is all to say that, to sort of back up your point, that none of this works if somewhere in the foundation of these stories there isn't some kind of rock solid, objective, old school reporting.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Greenlight. If you're a parent of teenagers, you might be starting conversations about money management and financial literacy. So often, the best way to learn is to do. But when it comes to money, there can be real consequences to learning the hard way. That's where Greenlight comes in. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their spending and saving. And kids and teens can build money confidence and lifelong financial skills. My kid is way too young to talk money with, thank God. But I have a colleague here at Vox that uses Greenlight with his boys, and he loves it. If you want to help your kids learn about money, consider Greenlight. It's a convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and for families to navigate this stuff together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
Let me take this from a couple different angles because I have very complicated feelings right here. And they tip, when I go into this, I tip on this like abyss of nihilism that I've never quite known how to resolve. So we're gonna go a bit deep into my psyche. So one, okay. I am certain, not knowing that particular ranking, that there is someone out there who has a valid criticism of it. And even if it's not true for that one, it is true for most of them. I, like you, spend a lot of time working off of academic work or think tank work that is in some ways trying to create a level playing field. I've done a lot of comparisons of international health systems, right? Trying to think about what would it be like if we had single payer or multi-payer or socialized healthcare or not. And, you know, I've looked at a lot of these different ways of ranking systems. The World Health Organization very famously had one that ranked the US 37, and that obviously made people very upset. And, you know, some of them are better than others, but certainly none of them are unimpeachable. And that's before you get into the question of, even if the ranking itself is well constructed, how well constructed is the underlying data? Because something I've become very sensitized to is often just how bad the data we're working off is. And then while I am developing, hopefully, maybe a scary level of, you could call it humility or fear, about the degree to which we know what we think we know, the degree to which the stuff that we are saying, look, it's based on this objective source, be that old school journalism, be that a Harvard study, be that a Brookings study, whatever it might be. Then on the other hand, I've gotten very deep into this research about how we make decisions when those decisions threaten our group identity. This research is very potent around politics, where the group identity of I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican or I'm a liberal or I'm a conservative is extremely and increasingly salient to people. And the big lesson of that research is not just that we are very flawed thinkers, that this idea we have that we are reasoning our way to truth is often an elaborate way we deceive ourselves when we are really reasoning our way back into our own group, but that the smarter you are, the better you are at doing this to yourself. That it is actually not the case that more education and more intellectual horsepower protects you from self-deception. In fact, in many ways, you become better at self-deception because you are better at gathering facts and coming up with arguments that support your side. And on the one hand, I believe all this to be true. I believe that a lot of the foundation we're working off of is flawed, and I believe the tool with which we are working atop that foundation is pretty flawed. And on the other hand, what's the alternative? You're just going to be paralyzed and never write a thing. And so I often have this a little bit dual psyche as I'm doing this work, where on the one hand, I feel, and possibly, you know, you've experienced this, where on the one hand, I think this is the right thing to be doing. I think this is the right thing to be writing. And on the other hand, my baseline view of how all of this work would be perceived by someone who really did have perfect information and really was perfectly objective. I'm sure when people look back at us 50 years from now, 100 years from now, we will have gotten really big things wrong and look very, very, very dumb. And I'm not exactly sure how to manage those two beliefs simultaneously without just, you know, leaving and going working at a, you know, at a smoothie stand.
Well, you please don't go work at a smoothie stand.
Smoothies are delicious.
I would say two things. I think that I agree with 98% of what you say. I would only say this, that we can reasonably, I think, make a distinction between those kinds of things that lend themselves to relatively transparent and objective analysis and those that don't. For example, I'm a big track and field fan. I'm obsessed with all of this stuff about doping and which athletes are or are not doping. What I did not realize until I began to read more in this is that the determination of whether an athlete is doping is itself an incredibly subjective process. It's not like a pregnancy test where it's either, you know, one color or another color. It's actually this thing where you have to look at all of this data and make a series of judgment calls. And there are legitimate cases where someone can be accused of doping and they didn't dope. So there's a case where, to your point, a huge amount of skepticism is necessary if you're going to discuss the problem, right? And you shouldn't, one needs to really look at hard and fast pronouncements in that area with a certain degree of caution. On the other hand, there are problems, questions that are simple enough that I think we can have a certain amount of certainty. So to go back to the question of generosity towards low-income students, there we're just dealing with two factors. You know, we have a definition of, we know the number of students who come from low-income families, and there's some uncertainty about that number, but we know we're within 98% of that correct number. We know the colleges tell us, and we know that their numbers are reasonably accurate, how many of those students they take in. And they also tell us how much of the tuition load they pay for each of those students. I mean, it's not a hard, that one's not hard. Now, you can quarrel with any of those, with using those three numbers as your definitive answer as to the generosity of a college in treating low-income students, fine. But I don't think there's much arguing about any of those specific numbers. Once you concede that we're looking at Pell Grant students and we're interested in how many they take and how much of their tuition they pay, it's not hard to know that Bowdoin does a pretty mediocre job and Vassar does a fantastic job and NYU does a job so appalling that they ought to be ashamed of themselves. Even NYU, if we called up the head of NYU right now and we said, you guys do a really shitty job of being generous towards low-income students, there is nothing, I believe, the president could say to defend himself. It's not arguable. The numbers are, you know,
Have you called him up and asked him that question?
I have not, since I didn't choose to focus on NYU, but would love to. I mean, if he's listening.
did anybody, while you were doing this, did you talk to anybody who came out poorly on this, who had a response that felt, even if it wasn't persuasive to you, it was compelling from their interests, right? That you understood, well, how a good person, a good institution was making decisions that ended with them looking terrible on these measures.
Well, I did. You know, the episode that just launched includes a long interview with John Hennessy, a president of Stanford, in which we get at this very issue. I asked him to justify Stanford's spending priorities, and I think he does a very poor job of doing it, because I think they are at root unjustifiable. So yes, in short answer. But I'll also say this, which is an interesting thing about podcasts, and I feel like, and I'm sure you deal with this with The Weeds, although I will say I think The Weeds does a better job of dealing with this problem than almost any other podcast. And that is that when you're talking, it's really hard to speak intelligently about numbers, right? It's astonishingly difficult to make a sophisticated statistical case on the radio or, you know, on a podcast. You can do it. That's the great, I mean, there's all these things you can do with your voice that you can't do in print. But that's one thing you could do in print you can't do with your voice. And I tried to dig into the numbers more in some of these podcasts that I've been doing on education. And I threw up my hands and I was like, I can't. I can make an emotional argument. I can make a broad kind of thematic argument. I cannot make a statistical argument because it doesn't, you can't use that many numbers in speech and expect to have anyone follow you. I was getting confused myself when I was saying it with all the numbers. I just had to take them out. And really, it's interesting. You realize a world in which the principal mode of communication is oral is a very different kind of world in which the principal form of communication is written. Something I hadn't thought about until I did a podcast.
I will say the thing about podcasting, and I do not understand this exactly, but one reason it is easier to talk about some of these issues is that in a way that feels similar to me to early blogging, people are a little more generous to the idea that you might be wrong and that might be okay. That might be part of searching mm-hmm. on these issues. That something that was fun about early blogging was that it had less authority behind it than newspapers did, than op-ed columns did, than magazines did. And so people would try ideas on for size, even if they weren't really sure they would fit. I know that you're a fan, as I am, of Tyler Cohen and mm-hmm. his blog Marginal Revolution. And he is a thinker who is interesting precisely because he's willing to, well, not precisely, there's a lot of reasons he's interesting, but one thing that makes him great is that he is willing to try on very weird ideas. And, you know, maybe he's only 40% sure about it. Maybe he's only 60% sure about it. Somehow yeah. podcasting, I find that folks are, they get that if you're just talking, that it's okay, you might double back. One thing on The Weeds that is fun is that I will often put out an idea and Matt or Sarah will make a counter argument. And I feel pretty often on that show, I'm like, well, okay, I actually see that point. Like, you're right, that was a bad idea. And that mm-hmm. makes it easier to talk about some of these trickier statistical issues, because one very hard thing about talking about numbers, either in print or also using data visualization, is I think we do a very bad job of talking about the limitations of numbers and the ways in which studies might be wrong. There mm-hmm. is a very subtle, but I feel very powerful incentive towards coherence imposed by most of the formats in which we write. And the push is towards actually having like one point on a study. If a study said, as Roland Fryer's recent one did, that African-American men are not killed at a higher rate by police when they're stopped, then that is what and that's like the main point of the study, then that is really the main point of the article. And even stuff that undermines it, you can only sort of gesture at. And I find that one reason this format is nice is that you can be a little rambling. It doesn't have to be one point. Mm-hmm. People are open to you just making a bunch of points. And then at the end, just kind of moving on, not wrapping it in a bow. I think the need to wrap things in a bow and impose a coherence that often you're thinking on something doesn't really have is a genuine weakness of a lot of our published news-oriented work right now.
Well, this is funny because this is something that I've thought about for years as a child of an academic. So my father taught math, and he would constantly be going off to conferences. And as a kid, I would always ask myself, why on earth is he going to conferences? What possible value is there for him to go and present a paper when they could just send someone the paper? It's equations, right? Like, isn't it just easier just to read the equation? And I was always very skeptical. I thought, well, you know, my father's going to Istanbul this summer because they all want a vacation in Istanbul. But now I realize that to exactly what you're saying, there is a reason why there is so much emphasis in academia on person-to-person oral presentation of arguments, data, what have you. Because when it's presented in oral form, it's so much easier to honor the conditionality of the work, to argue with it, to fix, to backtrack, to amend, to all those things. The minute it's on paper, it has a kind of permanence and authority that maybe it doesn't deserve. And whenever I often forget to do this, but whenever I read an academic paper, I always try to imagine in my mind the author of the paper presenting it orally. And that helps me to not jump in head over heels with some of the conclusions, to imagine their voice when they came to the conclusions. Because, you know, when you, in every conclusion of an academic paper, you know this, there's always a point where they recognize all of the potential problems with the conclusion. This may not be true because A, B, and C. When you're reading it, you skip over that. You're like, I'm not interested. I want to know what the conclusion is. But if they were presenting it, you know that actually would be a crucial point in the presentation. Everyone in the room is waiting for you to go through all the reasons why it might not be true, because that's where the discussion is going to begin, right? So the very thing that is almost of principal importance in the oral presentation is an afterthought when it's on the page. What goes on in The Weeds, for example, is I think you are restoring academic research to its appropriate environment, which is in that kind of in the conditional mode of ordinary speech. By the way, I am plugging The Weeds. I deserve money for this.
You do. And I will slip you that 100 we talked about earlier after the show. Let me ask you about the other side of this. I don't know if you saw this recent book by Chuck Klosterman, What If We're Wrong?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he does, it's this great book of essays, and it is him trying to imagine what we will have been wrong about in the future, or at least mm-hmm. which of our judgments will seem completely off. And he sort of goes through this in music, and he goes through it in film and literature, and he talks about, you know, how our understanding of gravity might update. I'm curious if there are things that you talked a little bit ago with the college study about something you're pretty sure is not going to change. Are mm-hmm. there things or classes of things that are conventional wisdom now that when you look at it, you think, well, that is clearly going to change. That is clearly something that in 100 years is going to look bad.
Huh. Well, I'll toss out two random thoughts. I think there'll be a good deal more skepticism towards institutional medicine. I think that we're going to wake up one day and realize that we fell in the kind of post-war years into this weird infatuation with things that happen in a doctor's office in a hospital at the expense of really prosaic things that enhance health. I feel like academics are already moving in that direction, but I feel like the public is going to follow, and you're going to realize that actually exercise and a decent diet gets you 85% of the way home, and much of what you're spending billions of dollars on is just useless. I think the internet, as it is presently configured, in 50 years from now, or even 25 years from now, is going to seem like a really bizarre experiment gone awry. That the idea of building a system, basically a platform for every fundamental human interaction that is incapable of defending itself, is insane. I mean, insane.
What do you mean defending itself?
Well, I mean, okay. Exhibit number one of completely insane public policy argument, Hillary's emails. So people jumping up and down because Hillary broke a rule and used a private server and her BlackBerry for stuff that she should have kept on the State Department server, right? Meanwhile, the State Department server has been hacked so many times, we've lost count. I mean, 2 years ago, they had to shut down all the servers because there was Russian malware on it they couldn't get rid of. Then there's like Snowden makes off with the entire contents of, you know, every diplomatic cable going back. And then OPM gets hacked, every single file of every American who's ever applied for a national security clearance is in the hands of the Chinese. The federal government, the entire cyber apparatus of the federal government is Swiss cheese, right? And yet we're still somehow having an argument about, oh, she might have had something on her BlackBerry. If it's on her BlackBerry, it's 100 times safer than it would be on the State Department server, right? Like, it was the most surreal. It's the kind of argument that you could only have if you are completely out of touch with the monster that you've created. And the monster is indefensible. It can't defend itself. It's built so that random people in Bulgaria can hack in at the drop of a hat, right? Every major institution in this country has been hacked, including institutions who you would have thought their principal mode of, one of their number one priorities was to prevent themselves from being hacked. And so it's like, how long can this go on, right? I mean, at a certain point, we're going to say we need a new internet. Like, the internet is a fuck up. I mean, it's like, I don't understand why no one sees this. Here I am. I'm a customer of Citibank. Why hasn't Citibank come to me and said, Malcolm, we are terribly sorry, but there is nothing we can do to defend your finances from being hacked? I'm sorry. So if you pay us $1,000 a year, we'll put you in an entirely new system, which we think reduces your chance of being hacked by 90%. Would I pay the grand? Oh, yes, I would pay the grand. Why hasn't Citibank done this? Because they're numbskulls. Like the rest of us, they're living with their head in the sand. They literally have their head in the sand. So does the State Department. So does everybody. I don't understand this. I mean, I was at a conference with a bunch of IT guys, IT security guys from major American corporations. We had lunch. It's like me and 15 of these people. We start talking. Turns out that not a single one of them has satellite radio in their car. I was like, really? why not? And like, they looked at me like I was a blithering idiot. They're like, are you kidding me? That's how they get in. Right? That's the point of vulnerability. You got to sound like radio. Your car is like open season for anyone who wants to hack in. I was like, oh, shit. Now you tell me, right? Like, if you're at an IT conference and none of the IT guys have satellite radio, doesn't that signal something? It's like going to a doctor's conference and discovering not a single one of them uses antibiotics. That would be a wake-up call, wouldn't it? So, I mean, anyway, that I get hyper about this because I just think this is insanity on every level. But anyway, I think the internet is going to seem like we're going to say, Jesus, what were we thinking?
But you know what's fascinating about that to me? There are a couple of things I want to say on that. But one of the things that I like about your Citibank example is that I think almost nobody would pay the $1,000. And the reason I'm pretty sure of that is that the lengths to which people will go to not have to ever change a password is extraordinary. Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I am somebody, one of these people. I recently did get hacked, actually. There is a group out there that has been just sort of going around, and they figured out this kind of neat trick. And basically, they wait, as you say, all of these big servers have been hacked. And so they got a bunch of passwords in a dump of hacks of, I think it's LinkedIn, Quora, and Foursquare, if I'm not wrong. And they hacked all these people and all these big like tech people like Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk and then smaller people like me. And what they did was they realized that we had all given access to our Twitter and Facebook pages that we actually probably keep under pretty good lock and key. Like I have two-factor authorization and the whole thing, like very unique passwords and all that. But we had given this access to these sort of throwaway accounts, you know, like I didn't even know I had a Foursquare account anymore. And so somehow they got the password that I had not done two-factor, had not protected heavily into the Foursquare account and then used that to post into my Twitter account. And I mean, it's the most mild way you can be hacked. They just put up a little note being like, you've been hacked. People should come to our website and buy our security services. So it was more than anything, a reasonable wake-up call. But one, it was incredibly violating, but also made me realize how many things I have not taken the time to fortify and that I did, but that I hadn't there. And I think that one of the interesting just points of vulnerability is not that the systems are so easy to hack. It's that we really, really, really somehow dislike the work of making them not easy to hack, of having hard to remember passwords that are written down on a piece of paper in our house, even when we know better. And then something goes wrong and then we feel really stupid for having not done it. But the great vulnerability here doesn't feel to me like it's the internet. It feels to me like it is our discounting of a future in which something terrible happens to us. And to some degree, that actually connects your health example too. In both cases, I kind of agree with what you're saying that the technology on which we are basing our futures is a lot worse than we think it is. But one of the reasons it is such a big problem is that it is very hard for us to do the annoying, often shitty stuff now that makes it so we won't need to rely on that technology in the future.
Yeah, although not hard to imagine. I agree with all that you said. I will only say about the internet that it was specifically designed to be open. That's the design flaw in retrospect.
Interesting.
It should not be designed. It was, you know, everything that we deal with hacking is not a bug of the internet. It's a feature of the internet. And we have to fundamentally redesign it if we're going to ultimately deal with hacking. But yeah, we are. I mean, people are ludicrously complacent about all of this.
It also seems to me that we are just a couple of years from the way we interface with all this feeling very archaic. I'm very much a believer that 10, 15, 20 years, just we are going to have a lot more voice stuff, a lot fewer passwords, that this space and this moment in how we interface with technology is going to pass through fairly quickly.
I agree with that. No, I mean, biometrics, I mean, alone. I mean, when I enter the country, I look in, they do a retinal scan. I don't understand why that retinal scan isn't everywhere. I mean, if the federal government has got retinal scans at the border, I mean, then, I don't understand why Chase doesn't have a retinal scan when I, you know, or Citibank. To the other point about health, I mean, this is a complete tangent, but this understanding that 85% of the problem is about diet and exercise. When that's taken seriously, that means we'll look back on the notion that kids are continuously in school, in a classroom, from, 8 to 4 or what have you, as being absurd. 15, 20 years from now, you will have situations where kids are doing 2 hours a day of physical exercise. That could be I could be totally making that up, but I could see that as a legitimate outcome of people starting to understand much better about what are the optimal learning situations and what is best for an individual's welfare.
Do you think it is possible to have learning situations that individualize more? I mean, I think about this a fair bit. So I did terribly in school. And I mean, not the kind where it's like, oh, I got a 3.5, but like really like failed classes constantly, barely got into college. It was a bad scene. And in retrospect, something I've learned about myself as an adult and just did not recognize at the time is that I am in some pretty fundamental way deficient at listening to someone lecture. It is not a way even now I can learn. Like I just do not, as a journalist, call into teleconference calls because I cannot. Like something in my brain shorts and I just zone out immediately. And on the one hand, I think that we have an understanding that people's learning styles are dramatically different, that is so far advanced compared to how many ways we let kids learn that it just seems bizarre. We can look at this and say we know better. And on the other hand, it's a big system. You've got to educate a lot of kids. You've got to be worrying oftentimes about the kids who are worst off. And, I wonder if we ever would have the ability to be significantly more differentiated in order to create models more like the one you're talking about.
Even modest steps to address basically heterogeneity in learning styles can go a long way. So will we ever have individualized instruction? By the way, I'm not even sure that's a good idea. I think that to a certain extent, it's not a bad idea to force people who learn one way to learn another way because you're just adding another arrow in their quiver. But I do think some relatively crude steps. So it's not clear to me at all that, particularly in elementary and middle school, that boys and girls belong in the same classroom. It doesn't make any sense to me. An 8-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl are so profoundly biologically distinct creatures. It's absurd to think that you can satisfy both simultaneously. So, I mean, there's that. I mean, I just think moving back to single-sex education until well into high school would go a long way. Even, really simple things like starting school later for teenagers would go a long way. That a lot of what we now perceive as individual differences in learning styles may simply be, at least on teenagers, manifestations of the fact they don't get enough sleep. I mean, I think lack of sleep probably accentuates this kind of heterogeneity. I think we'll get smarter about, I hope we get smarter about creating conditions that are a bit more forgiving of these differences. And I would point out that with you, the system actually, it does work in the end. You have a non-traditional entry point, but you actually do end up, the system does what it's supposed to do, which is it educated you and found a home for you in the world that you like. So isn't it fair to say that your childhood is, although it is on an unconventional one, it's a successful trajectory?
I think that's probably right. Although the one place I'd be careful about that is that I had a lot of privileges and second chances that other kids wouldn't get. I got into college on SATs, just flat. Otherwise, I don't get into college. And, my father, like yours, is a mathematician at a university. And we understood how the SATs worked, right? I was in a prep class. I knew that if I scored above a certain level, I triggered, University of California eligibility. So there are just places where as you say, it worked out for me, but I would be careful about how much I would generalize that
you
experience.
You need to be in the forgiving educational environment of Canada. We would have happily taken you.
and to be fair, I mean, there is the community college world. And so there are definite pathways and pathways that would have worked even if things had gone a bit worse. Let me move to something that I wanted to try out with you because you've worked alongside or reported on a lot of people I'm very fascinated by. And if you're open to experimenting with this, I'd like to ask you what you learned from a couple of them.
Sure.
Atul Gawande.
Well, Atul, there is in fact nothing to be learned from Atul Gawande, in the sense that there's nothing to be learned from the people who are in the 99th percentile are there. They can't be role models because you can't do what they do. Atul is, he does five things simultaneously. He is a professor at Harvard, a surgeon, a parent. He runs an incredibly successful nonprofit. He writes best-selling books. He's on a bunch of boards and he writes brilliant journalism for The New Yorker. He's not a useful way. You can't look at him and say, oh, I would like to live my life the way Atul does. He's a one-off. So I don't know what do I learn from Atul? I'm just sort of appropriately intimidated by his example, but I don't, there are journalists who I have learned a lot from, but I am incapable of extracting anything useful for myself from Atul's record.
David Remnick.
David is very, the best thing about David is David's very blue collar. David is all about putting the work in. David values productivity, shoe leather. He no flash or he likes, if you write two well-reported 10,000 word pieces, he likes you twice as much than if you write one well-reported 10,000 word piece. That is an incredibly useful advantage to have in an editor. He's very, very clear in what he values from his writers.
Bill Simmons.
Simmons is infinitely interesting, almost to the point where, so I will read anything he writes and I listen to all of his podcasts. And when I watch his TV show, he interviews all these interesting people. I'm actually not interested in what they have to say. I'm really only interested in what he has to say. It's almost a problem. The best talk show hosts are those who there's some balance between they have the gift of bringing out the best in their guest, or they have the gift of getting really interesting people on their show and they kind of fade a little bit into the background. And the problem with Simmons is he's never going to have a guest who's more interesting on sports than he is. That's a sort of an extraordinary gift, I guess, for someone who's a sports writer. He's surrounded by people who, in that business, who are not interesting at all, right? It's hard to be interesting day in, day out about professional sports.
If I am right about when you were at the Washington Post, Len Downey.
Leonard, yes, was Bradley hired me and then had retired within the year. And Leonard was the editor when I was at the Post. Leonard was the kind of epitome of the old school newspaper man. So if Bradley was flashy and charismatic and Leonard was a, you know, when we were talking earlier about the kind of necessary formalism of traditional journalism, that is Leonard. Buy the book. You do it right. You don't publish anything that isn't perfectly sourced and perfectly fair. And incredibly, you know, as someone whose tendencies are all in the opposite direction, really, really useful for me to spend 10 years at the Washington Post under Leonard Downey. And by the way, while I'm on this particular rant, if Leonard Downey had been within 50 miles of the Gawker newsroom, Gawker doesn't get sued. Can I just point that out? Like this whole bullshit about the First Amendment. No. They didn't have a Leonard Downey there who didn't say when they ran something, thinking of running something, if you run this, you'll get sued. Leonard, crucial force in my journalistic upbringing.
I think something so interesting about what you just said there, though, is that it speaks so much to culture of places. I have this sort of personal rule that over time, an organization will manifest both the best of its culture and its worst. And mm-hmm. its good will ultimately always be its bad. And, you know, the best of Gawker was its willingness to blow past the line, its willingness to run stories other people weren't interested in or wouldn't touch. It breaks the Rob Ford stuff, the mayor of Toronto, was it? Mm-hmm. And does a lot of great work like that. But over time, part of that is it's outing people constantly. Like that was a big obsession of Gawker's mm-hmm. in the early years. And ultimately, of course, they really do that to the wrong people. In fact, I don't think it should be done at all. But even if you have a different view on that than I do. They do it to the CFO of Condé Nast
in
a way that was absolutely
unspeakable.
Abhorrent.
And it's unspeakable.
And, you know, they ultimately, the place's own culture owns it. And, you know, I think you see that in all these places, right? Like the Len Downey Washington Post would never have had that problem. It would have only had the problems that emerge from the Len Downey Washington Post. Vox will have the problems of Vox's own culture. I think it's such a... I think one thing we tend to do is we will look at the great error of a place and say why, and often not recognize that what was bad about it or what created the problem was also what was good about it. And you can't, it's very hard to completely get rid of the mistakes without also blunting what makes organizations kind of great.
Yeah. It's my absolute favorite aphorism. It's the retail aphorism. You can, something can be cheap. Something can be good and something can be fast, but it cannot be all three. It can only be two. Pick two, right? Well, there's a version. You can do a version of that for almost any place. Well, journalism can be, you know, brave, high quality, and free of controversy, but it cannot be all three. You know, it cannot be all three. You pick your two. Or tasteful maybe is the third one. But there is necessary, you know, next time you order a couch, remember that. It can't be a great couch, a cheap couch, and come quickly. Didn't happen.
You did a great piece a while back on Apple and Xerox and Xerox Park and that era. So I don't know that you knew him, but what do you think, what did you learn studying Steve Jobs in that era?
I mean, I did that piece and a subsequent piece that talked about him as he was a tinkerer. He took other people's ideas and made them better as opposed to blazing the trail himself. That was a really, and subsequently I've read a lot about, there's a whole literature about tinkerers and the Industrial Revolution suggesting that that is what England's advantage was. England did not have more geniuses. England had more tinkerers, which also feeds into all of my educational obsessions at the moment. This country is overwhelmingly obsessed with the 99th percentile and having the best possible 99th percentile. And I think we should be overly obsessed with the 60 through the 80th percentile or the 55 through the 85th percentile. That's our sweet spot. We got to have lots and lots and lots of pretty good people as opposed to a small number of great people. That to me is the Steve Jobs lesson. He wasn't this brilliant innovator. He was just a guy who could take these things that were out there and tweak them 10% and turn them into. And that's what you want a lot of. That's actually, there isn't a shortage of the really brilliant ideas. What there's a shortage of is the kind of scale of people, the mass of people necessary to turn works of genius into usable objects. And I don't think we have that mass. Our mass isn't large enough. Now we're, you know, into my elite school critique, which I go on about ad nauseum in revisionist history. So that's the one thing that is really interesting to me about Jobs. And just the other thing, of course, is the often observed fact that he is a jerk. As if necessarily so. And that if you want to have what he built, you have to be tolerant of jerks. I don't know whether not all of it, but a lot of what he did was the kind of thing that you can only get with someone who is a complete monomaniacal, egotistical, narcissistic asshole.
What do you think is different in a society that is oriented better towards its 60th percentile? Like in broad strokes, I recognize it's a big question.
Yeah, I think that you have a lot less. I mean, that's sort of Germany, right? If you had to very, very simply illustrate the difference between Germany and America, it's that Germany is actually very, very interested in its 65th percentile. So what's the difference? You have much more income inequality. You have an atmosphere that for the very, very best and brightest can seem a little stifling. That's the price you pay. You know, their love of cars is really interesting along these lines. And the kind of status that a mechanic has in Germany is way higher than a status a mechanic has in North America. Or the status that I was doing some work on my house and got these windows from Germany, and the company sends a guy from Germany to deal with the windows and make sure they're put in properly. And it was kind of like, I mean, these aren't the world's most expensive windows, but that's the ethic of the company, that we're going to send this middle manager to New York. This guy who probably, I don't know what he makes. He makes probably a standard middle class, but such is the status attached to that standard middle class job, and such is the kind of status attached to the making of windows, that they're going to send the guy across the ocean to make sure the windows are put in properly. I just thought, it's like, I just found that absolutely fascinating. And so the window guy feels legitimately that he is a valued member of the economy. And I just, I'm in love with that notion that you can make the maximum number of people take that level of, feel genuinely and legitimately proud of what they do.
Tyler Cohen.
I love him. Marginal Revolution is the second website I read every morning without fail. We were talking about him earlier, but his complete, his intellectual generosity is without peer. He reads in order to locate what he likes in the thing that he's reading. And that's just that. He, the only person that I think that comes close to him is Dwight Garner, the book review critic for the New York Times, who also reads in order to find what is pleasurable in what he's reading. That notion of being so open to what you can discover in the world of ideas is intoxicating. I mean, that's not too strong a word to attach to Marginal Revolution and to the reviews of Dwight Garner.
What is the best advice you've received?
I always quote this thing, which I realize is, because this is going to sound really stupid, but I remember reading this great line from, this is always my fallback advice. There's a John Wooden quote, "Be quick, but never hurry," which I love. And I always have turned it around overhead and around in my mind, wondering about exactly what he meant by that. But it seems to me really profound somehow.
It's funny. I have a piece of advice I heard from a friend, actually, that is very similar to that, that I've always loved and I actually spend a lot of time thinking about, which is go slow to go fast.
Oh, yeah. I think they're getting the same thing. Whatever it is, it's really profound. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's profound.
No, I totally agree. There is something there that we were, this came in context of building something, of building infrastructure. And yeah. It's like for a big camping project. And this is somebody who knew a lot more about camping than I did. And I really like that. I do not know that I have figured out how to apply it, but oftentimes when I'm feeling very rushed and frenzied and anxious, I try to put that back in my mind and remember that I'm probably, in trying to go this fast, fucking something up that is ultimately going to slow me down.
Yeah.
What are three books that have mattered to you that you think people should read?
Oh, wow. Well, I always mention The Person in the Situation, which is a book by Nisbet and Ross from 40 years ago, which is the kind of book that got me thinking about psychology. It's a book sort of against personality and in favor of contextual influences, environmental influences on our behavior and belief. It's a beautiful book. This is cheating. My mother wrote a memoir in the late 60s, which is one of the first adult books I ever read, and which probably planted the seed in me of wanting to become a writer at some point or wanting to write, because it was a very beautiful book called Brown Face Big Master. And a kind of early, you know, before the whole tide of memoirs by young women, Joyce Gladwell, 1969. So I like to think my mom, pioneer this is very, very random, but I always love it. I go back and reread it. Elliot Cohen. Do you know Elliot Cohen, who's a military historian at CSIS?
Yeah, I've definitely seen his work. I don't know him personally.
He writes great books about, he's a military wonk, but he wrote a book called Military Misfortunes, which is about the military by a military guy that's not about the military. It's just such a lovely, it's just one big, beautiful allegory about the kinds of mistakes people, high stakes mistakes, decision makers make, why they make them. And I love, you know, as you can imagine, anyone who can write about X and make a much broader point about Y is someone who's a hero in my book. And that's I mean, I've plucked that out of many books that have influenced me, but that's a particularly beautiful example of how to do that particular journalistic feat.
Malcolm Gladwell, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ezra.
That was Malcolm Gladwell. Thank you to him for being on the show. Everybody should listen to his new podcast, Revisionist History. Thank you to my producer, AC Valdez. The Ezra Klein Show is a production of Vox.com and Panoply. I'll see you next week.